Representative Paulson, I don't have a quorum. In fact, I don't have anybody besides me and Representative Paulson, chair and vice chair. But if you'd want to come forward and start presenting your bill, I think then we could move it for possible inclusion in the omnibus. This is going to have to go to taxes because it's tax credits. Yes, Representative Paulson, welcome to the committee. House Bill 2779.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and we'll just have a couple of people that are available to testify as well. And Mr. Chairman, the bill that is before you is establishing these lifelong learning accounts, LILAs as they've been known, and I think we all know that your involvement with the workforce issues here, Mr. Chairman, is very, very important. As the 21st century continues to evolve, there are skill levels that are gained in initial education and training environments are sometimes not enough to meet the needs and the demand for advanced skills and opportunities, and abilities for that matter. And the Hudson Institute has reported that about 60% of future jobs will require training that only 20% of the present workforce actually possesses. So these lifelong learning accounts are employer-matched, portable, individual earning accounts, much like 401ks, that would be used for skill building and career advancement, and they've been very successful in being targeted towards lower-income individuals in some states where these have been piloted, and it's a great way of really addressing the challenge of updating our education and our workforce system. So I won't spend much time on this, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to have, I think we have a couple of people who would be happy to testify on the provision.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Why don't you go ahead and just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Randall K. Johnson, and I'm State Policy Director for the Council on Adult and Experiential Learning. And today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about lifelong learning accounts, which my organization, the Council for Adult and Experiential Learning, also known as CAEL, which is a national nonprofit organization based in Chicago. We actually developed lifelong learning accounts in 2000. And the goal was to create a new way for employers and employees to co-finance education and training. The idea is that LILAs help workers and companies to effectively leverage funding resources to increase productivity, improve retention, and meet the changing needs of the global economy. Specifically, much like 401ks, employees contribute regularly to LILAs, and employers match these contributions on a dollar-for-dollar basis up to an established annual cap. From 2001 to 2007, CAEL conducted a multi-sector LILA demonstration in Chicago, Northeast Indiana, and San Francisco, with funding from 25 local and national foundations, as well as state sources. This pilot serves more than 350 participants in four industry sectors. And from our experience working on these sites, we've drawn a number of different conclusions. The first is that LILAs were of interest to both individual workers as well as employers. CAEL wrote 359 individual workers and 37 employers from four different sectors in our multi-year program. Individuals and employers were also pleased with their experience. An evaluation of a demonstration done by Public Policy Associates has found that between 88 and 90% of participants were satisfied or very satisfied with their lifelong learning accounts. Similarly, all but three of the 29 responding employers reported they were very or somewhat satisfied. LILAs also proved to be an effective asset building strategy. The average monthly contribution of LILA participants was $33.82, and the average total contribution was $783.72 over a year. All individual contributions were matched by the participating employers up to $500, and the demonstration also matched both the employee and employer contributions in the amount of $500 for a total match of $1,000. Participants also used their LILAs for education and training. 84% of participants who made regular or significant contributions to their lifelong learning accounts took at least one class. And across all sites, the average LILA expenditure per participant was right around $2,000. The total participant dollars spent on education and training was very significant. It was $94,038, and it allowed them to leverage a total of $92,184 from employers. LILAs also served as a catalyst to promote education and training. Approximately half of all LILA participants in all the different sectors stated they had not had any plans whatsoever to enroll in education and training courses prior to their participation. And finally, LILAs improved retention. Based on an initial review of the participants' individual learning plans, which they developed in consultation with career advisors, we found that 70% of all participants across all sites use Lattice for goals related to their current job, begin a promotion with the same employer, or related work with the same employer in the same industry. These findings show more often than not, employees choose courses of study that benefit the employer in some way. And this proposed Minnesota LILA initiative could not be better timed. By adopting the statewide LILA initiative, the state of Minnesota would be positioning itself at the vanguard of the national LILA movement, which would allow the state to compete for selection as part of the national LILA initiative. This past year, on January 4th, Senators Maria Cantwell and Olympia Snow introduced the Federal Lifelong Learning Accounts Act of 2007. And if passed, this bill would create a 10-state demonstration program in which states would compete competitively and be selected by the Secretary of the Treasury. The proposed Minnesota initiative largely is in keeping with the work that we've done in previous LILA demonstrations, especially with respect to targeted outreach to lower income and lower skilled healthcare, hospitality, and technology workers, and with respect to the geographic, contextual, and demographic mix of participants, the provision of technical assistance to companies and career advising employees, as well as the creation of means of documenting LILA program outcomes. So in closing, we'd like to congratulate the state of Minnesota for addressing the tough challenge of updating their state-level education and workforce systems to meet the changing needs of the local, state, and national economies. It takes visionary leadership for your government, business, labor, and education from government, business, labor, and education to accomplish these goals. So Gail is pleased to support your current efforts to create lifelong learning accounts and longer-term efforts to create new competitive advantages for your state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Josh, and President Paulson, we have another witness. Welcome to the committee, ma'am. If you just identify yourself.
Thank you. I am Valerie Pace for the IBM Corporation. IBM has announced a matching learning account program for our employees, which will roll out in July of this year, based much on the model just discussed. The reason IBM is doing this is because our employees are keen to invest in education, and the company has traditionally made significant investments in employee education over the years. But that is always business related. And in many cases, we find our employees would like to transition to second careers and have the flexibility and option to pursue certification to teach or other career opportunities that would not necessarily align with the current skills they share in the job. So this program gives employees the opportunity to invest with a 50% match by IBM so they can put away $1,000 a year with another $500 for future educational expenses. This is particularly important for adult learners who don't traditionally qualify under the rules of financial aid in higher education institutions. And it's a way to allow employees to be planful and invest in their future and take ownership for the skills necessary to remain competitive. We're very excited about the program and what it will bring to our employees. We're beginning it in the United States with plans to roll it out worldwide. So we think that the opportunity for Minnesota to show leadership is very important here, and we appreciate Representative Paulson bringing this forward. It is very clear that as an employer, and therefore, I believe as a state, the opportunity to recruit and retain talent and continue to developing the skills of the workforce is key for our long-term future success. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions at all? Mr. Johnson, probably. Is it typical, like on a federal level, is the pilot program you mentioned, or that it goes to Department of Labor and Industry, or maybe Representative Paulson, I don't really understand. Would Office of Higher Education or somewhere else be a better place to...
And Mr. Chairman, I can comment on that. When we had the bill drafted, you know, we were working based on past experiences in other states, and, you know, DEED might be an appropriate venue to administer, or HESTO potentially, but yeah, that probably makes more sense than Dell, and that would certainly be within the realm of the committee to determine the most appropriate venue.
Do you, Representative Paulson, do other states... that have this right now, direct it, Mr. Johnson, maybe you can help.
The state of Maine actually does it through their Department of Labor.
Oh, okay.
They actually also use their 529 system to deliver it.
Well, I'm sure Speaker Swiggum would like a little extra cash over there at the Department of Labor and Industry that he can, you know, use. But I guess the other thing, do you have a fiscal note on the cost of this, Representative Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, no, I've just been requested. There's nothing right now.
Do you have any idea of the potential liability?
No, but I think it obviously can be scaled. I'm not sure what the revenue impact would be on the tax side as well. I know the revenue impact study will be done, but maybe it's based on some of the pilot programs, I'm sure Johnson could comment on that. It can be scaled however I think it's appropriate.
Yeah, it would actually depend upon the particular configuration of the program, the needs of the state, and the existing infrastructure. And as a result, we couldn't give a specific cost at this time, but we'd be more than willing to work with the members of this committee and any agencies necessary to develop a cost structure that's appropriate for Minnesota.
Okay. Other questions of the committee at all? Representative North.
Not a question. I just want to recognize IBM, and they are wonderful community partners, and they have a whole variety of very creative opportunities for their employees. This is just one example, and so they've been wonderful to work with as partners with our education system in almost all realms of our community. So thanks for being here and sharing your story.
Thank you. Representative Paulson, when I do get a quorum, which I only need a few more members now, we will re-refer this bill, I'm sure, to taxes, where you want it to go, right?
Correct.
And if there's any questions I have about Dolly and that, I'll talk to you about it, and we can maybe see if that's the appropriate place. Thank you very much, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't have any motions to make. I can't make any motions. I can't even call a meeting to order. Okay. We're getting closer now, though. Thank you very much, then.
Thank you.
They went to get Representative Mullery. Representative Haas, do you want to take up your bill right now? House File 3363.
Mr. Chairman,
welcome.
Committee members, I would like to move a House File of 3363 and seek the advice of the chair to where you would like it to be moving to.
As soon as we get a quorum, we'll have you. I know you'll know what to do, Representative Oz. But why don't we just have whatever presentation you have, and then the witnesses can take it.
Thank you very much. Just give me a short presentation on my part and expertise here from the department. This is a housekeeping bill. It is some of the bills that we worked together on last year. It's in four parts, dealing with the American Indian Scholarship and with the movement from the Minnesota Department of Education to the Office of Higher Education. It is a possibility to bring the language, update the language to what is occurring and putting it into law so that they will be perfectly congruent between those two. Two of the aspects that they would be doing would be that the student, if they qualify for the American Indian Scholarship, they would have to also be qualified for the federal Pell Grant and the Minnesota State Grant. We're also dealing with some language changes to the Governor's Achieve Scholarship Program from last year, and indicating that they would have to come from a Minnesota high school, graduated from a Minnesota high school, and have had a standards of testing in the AP test scores. We're dealing with the Minnesota GI Bill, in which was a hard bill to get all set up, and at a later time, I will be running another GI Bill dealing with the dollars, but this is just pretty much a housekeeping changes, and it adds to the fact that when we're talking about served in a time of hostility, will be related to the medals awarded for that service, as well as the certificate, and that would be one of the criteria for judging that, which would make it a lot easier. Then the post-secondary, the fourth is the post-secondary data sharing, is the sharing between K-12 and higher education. This will be in an aggregate sense, will help out rather than in an individual so that they can judge groups within there to see if we are bringing along all the students in a manner that we should be bringing that. And with that, I will turn it over to our expert testifiers here to identify and to give us details on the bill.
Just a second, Representative Haas. First, we'll have Representative Ruth move that Mr. Representative Paulson's bill, House File 2779, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Tax Committee. Are there any questions on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Now, Representative Haas moves House File 3363, be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus higher education and workforce development bill. Mr. Canis, you want to take over first?
Mr. Chair and members of the board, my name is Mark Canis with the Office of Education. With me is Mr. Grimes. And Representative Haas did a great job with the overview, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how much detail you want to get into because this is clearly a technical bill.
Can I ask you one question on the bill? The free credits, do we have any other state grant programs where you can get state grant, where you get grant money for sharing free credits?
Mr. Chairman, Christy Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Currently in the state grant program, the requirement is that you have to be taking free credits or more to get a state grant program. So it would be the same requirement that we have in the state grant program. Is that what you were asking?
Yes. I thought there was another limit. Maybe that was for living and maintenance expense for some. Isn't there a threshold of 12 credits? Is that just for Pell?
Mr. Chairman, good question. For full-time, to get an award as a full-time student, you have to be taking 15 credits.
And that's higher than the federal.
The federal requirement is that you have to be taking 12. You're considered full-time if you're taking 12 credits. Semester credits are the equivalent or more. The state requirement is 15 credits.
But this 3 credits, then, is because this is a different program and not a full-time program. And
well, full-time students would have a similar requirement, but if they're attending part-time, they could get a grant as long as they're taking a course for 3 semester credits or more.
Are there any questions on the bill itself? And it seems to be basically a technical housekeeping bill. Are there any surprises of any kind in here, Mr. Canis?
Mr. Chair and members,
one
is I just want to assure the members on the Union Scholarship that we've taken some fuzzy practices in language and try to be very clear and succinct with them and to assure the community that no Union students will be affected in any negative way by those clarifications. And then I think it's the fourth article that might be considered less technical. Ms. Seeger, I think, wants to speak to that.
Ms. Seeger, welcome to the committee. Nice seeing you again.
Nice.
I saw you last night.
Nice to see you too, Mr. Chair. Susan Hegard with the Office of Higher Education. And the piece of the bill that I'd like to talk about is the student identification number. I want to give you a little bit of background on that because it is not purely technical. That is a new proposal, but we have this in the higher education bill as well as a standalone that Representative Mullery is going to be carrying for us. What this came from is that there's a P16 partnership that some of you may know about, and that's been a volunteer organization for about 5 years. The leaders of that organization, Bob Runix, Jim McCormick, and Alice Segrin, those three folks basically share the chairmanship of the organization. But all the education kind of stakeholder groups on higher education and K-12 are part of the P16 Council. 2 years ago, there were about 6 work groups set up. One of them, for example, was to look at math standards and have the math teachers and the math professors talking to one another to make sure there was alignment and that expectations of the two were similar. We were finding that there were some issues with students transitioning from high school into college. Another of the work groups was to establish a student identification number. And I led that particular work group for Commissioner Segrin. And we included members from all the education stakeholder groups and then a technical group from higher ed and K-12, smaller groups. Basically, what we were trying to figure out, and many states are looking at this, is there a way to have a number that you could use that would follow a student from K-12 into higher education? So, well, why the heck would you want to do that? Well, take remediation, for example. It would be wonderful to be able to figure out what made a difference and what did not make a difference in K-12 so that you could go back and use that information to improve the academic experience for students. We decided in our group to take something called the MARS number. That's an acronym. I don't know what it stands for. I can't remember, but it's the Minnesota Student Identification Number. Every student, when they come into kindergarten, public school student gets a MARS number with the state. and that follows that student throughout their educational experience. Our idea was to not create a new number, not to use a Social Security number. We'd take the MARS number and then run it up into higher education so that the systems would then have this number. They've used that in their own databases as well. And the group all agreed with this. They really liked the idea a lot. There's no additional cost involved. And so we've been meeting with legislators throughout state government and both houses to talk about this particular provision. The most important thing, I think, to understand is that, two things, is that this is academic. We're not looking at behavioral, you know, mental health data at all. It's educational academic data. The other thing is that the information would never be individually identifiable. We're prohibited from doing that, and we wouldn't want to do that. It's available in the aggregate. So you'd be looking at like groups of students, their curriculum that they've taken, their course load that they've taken, etc. So that's just a brief explanation. I'd be happy to answer questions for people. And I see Representative Mullery is here in the room.
So he's here on another bill.
He is.
So we won't let him handle that. Representative, and you know that, but that progressive libertarian streak in me always gets nervous when you put a number on a face, but you're saying you're not putting it on a face, you're putting a number on a collective group of faces.
Mr. Chair, there's already a number. We're just taking that same number and running it up into higher ed, but the number would never be individually identifiable for research purposes. It would be aggregate groups of students, and we'd have to go down to what they call, I guess it's a cell size, or there's a certain size at which you cannot go below that because the students are identifiable. So we're not interested, we're interested in students, but not individually. It's more the aggregate information that I think would be very helpful to us.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hegard, I just wanted to understand correctly then, this is not the student's identification number that they would be using for purposes of registering for classes or other things. This is a separate number that's only being used more for the collection of data. Is that correct?
Chair Rokovina and Representative Poppy, that's correct. It would not be the registration number. It would be a number that would be embedded kind of in their data. We collect data on the higher ed side now at our agency, and the K-12 agency collects data as well. This language would allow us to share data between us in the aggregate, and very specific data, not a whole broad kind of swath of data, but it's specific.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just have a follow-up that's different, but for a PSEO student who is in the system with a MARS number and then goes into a college setting and continues to have the MARS number, is there going to be a possibility to eliminate some of the paperwork that gets done between the high school and college if you've got a number and you've been able to collect some data and not have to then continue to collect it on a semester, you know, regular basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, I mean, I think that's certainly one of many things that we could look at after doing this. I think certainly there would be some streamlining and efficiencies that would occur. Again, though, the purpose of this is to try to improve the academic educational experience of the students, so whatever we could do to provide for that, I think we should consider.
I would just suggest that would be something, and if it's not done through this, maybe perhaps Mr. Chair, it's done in some way, that the paperwork could be diminished somewhat.
If I might just follow up, you know, another thing that I was just reminded that we've been working on is this concept of an electronic transcript, and that's another way that we're working right now with the Midwest Higher Education Compact to reduce paperwork, so that would also feed into this, I think.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious from the standpoint of our current policy in K-12, the MARS number, what are the legal protections for information in that number that exists now that school districts in K-12 are required to adhere to so that they protect the identity of a person from the information? And does that follow along with the sharing of the numbers? Does all of the legal responsibility then also follow, and what are the protective mechanisms in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I'm not an expert on data practices, but we did meet with the Department of Administration, Commissioner Segrin and I did, and they drafted the particular language in the bill. We're complying with both state data practices and the federal law, and there are very heavy penalties for anyone who violates those particular laws. So we would also have that require tennis and warnings and things for students in both higher education and K-12 to make sure that they were informed, they and their parents were informed about this. We do that already now. And then they could opt out if they did not want to participate.
Okay, no further questions, then I'll rep them by.
Sorry,
okay.
Chairman.
I'm not the person to cite freedom of speech.
I don't necessarily have a problem with continuing of the MARS numbers, and as a public educator, I can see that probably would make some sense. However, I'm concerned about a couple things. One is I'm wondering what this data would be used for, and you know, with my experience with No Child Left Behind and the gathering of data and the influence that data has on instruction and programs, and it's not always necessarily positive. And beyond that, I guess I'm wondering, in some respects, I could see value if you were looking at data and numbers, that there could be some value in looking at some of the things that you're excluding. When I work in alternative education, in a bill I was presenting earlier, we were looking at getting questions about, you know, are there certain students who have difficulties with mental health, for instance, as an example, and sometimes that could be useful in looking at programming or looking at what needs the university or the college might have to meet those needs. And I guess I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more either about what the data will be used for and why you would exclude those other items.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, a couple answers. First of all, I think the primary focus, our assignment when I was on the P16 Council, was to find a number that could be commonly used for. It was really for academic purposes. The Department of Education collects a whole bunch of data right now. Our office collects a whole bunch of data regarding enrollment. This language would just allow us to share some of that data with the workgroup. We kind of went through and we selected data. So I'll just give you an example. On the Department of Education side, the new data that we collect would be high school course curriculum. So we begin to get information about student course taking. And that you could learn if you saw particular patterns of course taking. You could then look at higher education and decide, did that make a difference in terms of the selection of majors? Were there more science or math majors? What kind of sciences were people taking in higher education? So the Department of Education would still continue to collect their data, the mental health data and all of that. We'd continue to collect ours, but there would be a more limited selection of data that we would be able to share with one another, agency to agency. I think the feeling was just that the primary focus of this was academic, and if we got into, you know, mental health and behavioral issues, that's something that I don't know much about. Commissioner Segrin, you know, his agency collects some of that information, I think, and school districts do, but that wasn't really the primary focus of what we were trying to do.
That's good enough. I see that Representative Briner wants to ask a question.
Do we have to get on this through my quarter? Well, we got backed up, and we can back them up. Sorry, everybody. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more by way of elucidation of the value of the number, I think. But we have a proposal in E-12 policy related to looking at the rigorous course completion numbers. And there's a lot of research data that's been done on what the course patterns of students at the high school level is that is predictive of success in post-secondary, and I'm sure you're very aware of this. And the value of a number would be to allow us to look more thoroughly at that research without having to create the burden of an additional research project where you identify students and follow them through. And over time, it will eventually allow us to be much more sophisticated in our judgment of what a rigorous set of courses is and how it influences post-secondary. So I see it as a tremendous value. Whether it ought to be extended to other measures, I think, is a question for the future. But just having the identifier and being able to follow our students' course patterns, I think, is a definite value for our ability to look more carefully at transitions and at supporting course-taking patterns in our students at an earlier age that will help them succeed.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions. Then Representative Hosley moves this motion. The House File 3363 to recommend the pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Workforce Development Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Mullery. Representative Welke, Representative McFarland moves the minutes of the February 26th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative McFarland will move the minutes of the 27th meeting. Thank you. Any corrections or additions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Welke then moves that House file. Let's see, where's the Mueller going? House File 2676 be recommended to pass, and Representative Mullery, would you prefer that this... it's got a fiscal note, so I guess I got to keep it here. Okay, be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education and Workforce Development Bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have no formality in this.
Oh, okay.
After all, I've given you two hearings already. So,
yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A boon to the North Side. This is a parenting leave bill, and it's similar to the one that we heard a few years ago. It was passed twice in the Senate. Basically, what it does is it's a paid parenting leave to the extent of two-thirds. In essence, the employer pays one-third, the state pays one-third, and the person, the family, actually, in essence, pays the other third for themselves. Almost everywhere in the world, in every industrialized country, there is paid parenting leave. Except in the United States, there are several states that have adopted paid parenting leave. And today we have, this actual bill was designed after a former Republican governor's company. Elmer Anderson instituted this at his company. And today we have Jim Koppel from the Children's Defense Fund and Amy Brennigan from the Council on the Economic Status of Women to testify on behalf of that. And Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I would like to go back and forth to make sure that I'm chairing it. And when Mahoney's very controversial bill comes up, I'd like to be there. So it's okay to
chair. That's fine. You go ahead and welcome to the committee. Whoever's going to go first, Jim, if you're going to go, I'll just identify yourself for the tape and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the director of the Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. The Children's Defense Fund is a research and advocacy organization, nonprofit that looks out for the needs of children to improve their lives. Happy to be here today. This bill actually grew out of a study we did in the late 90s where we looked at former Governor Anderson's ECM Publishing, which was a small business he owned and runs weekly, bi-weekly papers in Minnesota, Wisconsin, has about 500 employees, and he was very concerned with the 0 to 3 development of children, young children, and put forward a plan to his employees, which was modified. He wanted to give one employee one time a 3-year paid leave. And they came back to him and said, let's make it 1 year, and we could do it more than once. And so basically that's how it came. And his program is a little different. He basically pays 40% of the average salary over the last 3 years, I believe, that you've worked at the company. You have to be there a minimum of 2 or 3 years before you're eligible, but he basically paid 40% of paid leave. And we thought that in constructing this bill, the research we did and how this came about, the logistics of this, is we looked at the average income of new parents, so younger parents. So the average income is lower than the median income, say, in the state, because then you have higher earners later years. But when you're a young parent, we didn't do an exact math, but we came out at about $39,000 is a median income of a new parent in Minnesota, first-time parent. And so we were looking at it from a shared responsibility that the employer would put up a third of what that paid leave would be, in other words, a third of a $39,000 salary on a weekly basis. This would be over a course of a year. And the state would then match that third, and the employee would sacrifice their third, or self-pay. You know, so it'd be a two-thirds of that median income. That's how it was constructed. And what we wanted to do was really to put a higher value on paid leave in order that more parents who wanted to stay home for 12 to 16 weeks, this is allowed to go up to 26 weeks, but up to a half year, but there's really no financial way where many parents can take that time off and be at home. And we did have at the same time, historically, and I don't want to drag this out, but historically we had a child care subsidy where parents could actually receive the child care subsidy. And the author of that, who was a doctor from Marshall, a House member, had since retired, he was disappointed in it because he never felt like it was enough money, quite enough money, to actually allow a parent to stay home and take care of their child. So it was kind of a combination to look at how can we be meaningful in offering paid parental leave that doesn't break an employer, is enough for a parent to stay home, and ultimately gives real value to parenting. And when we say it's important to stay home and be with your child, you have to have quantity to get to the quality. And so this is a way for new parents for us to express as a society the value of parenting, and especially the value of new parents. So that's how the bill came about. It has been introduced numerous times here in the House and in the Senate. As mentioned, it has passed the Senate twice as a pilot project, and that's the history of it and why the logic of it fill you in on that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Koppel. Why don't we hold questions, members? Ms. Brennigan, if you wanted to make a few brief comments.
I will comment. Thank you. Thank you.
Committees are backing up, so.
I'm Amy Brennigan, Director of the Office on the Economic Status of Women. Just want to let you know a little bit where Minnesota stands in terms of what's happening in other states. Right now, all workers in California, Hawaii, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, and Puerto Rico have been covered for pregnancy and childbirth for a number of years under mandated temporary disability insurance. Since 2002, three states have expanded laws connected to paid parenting leave. And in California, the legislature created a paid family leave insurance program. In Washington, paid parenting leave was established in law just last year, and a task force is working currently on a means of paying for it. And even as we sit here today, this very same topic is being debated in the state of New Jersey. And I gave you a handout today just that helps describe kind of the momentum around paid parenting leave in the country. I think most of you know that FMLA is active, and the question is how can we allow people to use their FMLA more? This would complement that. Also, paid parenting leave has been shown again and again to be good for business. It creates retention, it creates loyalty, and it's a good plan for business in our state. Just building on what Representative Mullery said, internationally, our country is the only industrialized nation without paid family leave. It guarantees no paid leave at all for mothers, putting it in the company of three other countries, Liberia, Papua New Guinea, and Swaziland. So I think what's great about this bill, it's voluntary. It shares the burden of the cost among three different entities. It's good for families, it's good for women, and it's good for men. Thank you.
And finally, Mr. Lesko.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad,
chair of the bonding committee. We figured we'd back you up a few minutes. We got backed up an hour, Madam Chair. So.
Brad Letzel, from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and I'll be very brief. The national AFL-CIO has had a long position in favor of paid parental leave, which is also our position, the affiliate of the national AFL-CIO. And just to remind the committee that Minnesota was the first state in the nation in 1987 to implement parental leave legislation, and so we think we certainly would not be the first state in the nation to pay a portion of paid parental leave, but think it's an important step, and this is a moderate, I believe. Thank you.
Questions of the witnesses? Representative Easton.
I'm just kind of glancing at the bill here. One thing, just it says qualified paid parental leave must be at least 6 consecutive weeks in duration. Is there some reason for that if somebody wanted to take a shorter one?
Representative Mullery, do you want to take that, or Mr. Stoppel or Ms. Brennigan?
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Stoppel. Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastman, I'm going to go, I might not be giving the exact right answer here, but I'm going to do my best. It was based, a lot of this was based on what average leaves were. Our minimum leave in Minnesota, unpaid, is 6 weeks for companies between 20 and 50 employees. And so I think it was based on that minimum as a time that parents would take. It goes from 6 weeks as a minimum. Also, I think on the reimbursement and bureaucracy side of things, if you're going to set this up with an employer, you don't want it to just be for a week. There's quite a bit of, so I think it was just a minimum period of time that we felt would meet both of those criteria.
Okay. Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, is there a fiscal note on this?
There isn't a fiscal note. That's why I'm holding it over. We've requested one from the committee, and we'll see, because there certainly would be a fiscal impact if the state, you know, when the state did it, of course there's fiscal consequences for business, and I know you're concerned, but yeah, we requested a fiscal note. We'll keep it here, and we'll know that as we move it forward. No further questions, then Representative Welty renews his motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevail. I'll just do my one bill and we'll get out of here. And House File, if the committee would let me just do it from here, House File 3349 is a bill that just allows the, kind of like a housekeeping bill that allows the Office of Higher Education to use, it lets them use that living for grant money that's left over, and it lets them do it every year because there was a sunset on it. We're removing the sunset. That's all it does. They're living in maintenance expenses. Anything else that's left over at the end of the fiscal year to all of them to fall it back into the grant system. So if there are no questions on it, I'll move House File 3349 to be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Or no, I'm going to move this to the floor. Let it sit there in case I need it later. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And finally, my intention is to take up my bill 2629, and I have a delete-all amendment for it that members can look at if they want. The our capable committee administrator will give it to anyone who requests it, including the department if they want to see it. So, with that, members, thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow. Meeting adjourned. Excuse me. Not tomorrow. Monday. I thought it was Wednesday. I lost the day. I'm sorry. We'll see you Tuesday. Meeting adjourned.